Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. The other day I did an interview with Patrick. He's been very supportive in the past, and I was very grateful for this interview. And he wanted to discuss a number of things about the whites of South Africa, especially the Boers. And we touched on a bunch of topics, including history. It's actually the second interview I've done with him, and I've just not gotten around to publishing the first interview that we did. But he was extremely supportive, and I'm very grateful for his support in this regard, especially at this time when things are rather tricky over here.
Live from a bunker deep within the Appalachian Mountains, I bring you another episode of Surviving Via America. And this week, we have a very special guest that's going to come on and talk about the present predicament with the Boers and also a little bit about himself as well. He's been on this show before with Boer Jack. It brings me great pleasure to introduce Jan Lampert, who's been fighting for our people since forever, and he has a very great website called History Reviewed. And I'll let Jan introduce himself and take it away and talk a little bit about the current predicament of how his situation is going and how the Boer situation is going in Africa. South Africa. So go ahead, Jan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate it. Yeah, we've got quite a few things happening here in South Africa. A lot of the stuff is same old, you know, where you are in a rut and things aren't improving. But there are also positives. And among the positives that I like is I like to see my enemies struggling, and our enemies have been having a very nasty year. Things are not going well at all for our enemies. And here in South Africa, this COVID lockdown has made people quite crazy. We had quite an intense lockdown. It's not fully finished yet. I think we may be near level one, but we started out at like level five, and we weren't allowed to even move around outside our properties, etc. So we had an intense lockdown, and that worried a lot of people. And we also had a lot of economic problems come from that. And to give you an idea, in South Africa, we only have a workforce of about 16 million people out of 50 million. And in a single quarter, 2 million lost their jobs. And so people have lost their jobs, their houses, their businesses. It's been quite a wild time. And I personally think that it's going to be quite a while before the country even manages to recover properly from it. But the good thing is I'm an accelerationist, and for me, COVID has meant good things. It's woken up people in South Africa. It's freaked people out. People are looking around more than ever before, just like in the USA.
So how are the attacks on like the farmers now with the COVID situation? Are they still experiencing a lot of duress from the attacks that's occurring? Are the attacks more frequent, or have they kind of slowed down?
From what I can see, it seems to be pretty much the same. However, there is a new thing that's come up that I need to look at more closely, and that is that blacks have been running around setting places on fire. So I remember seeing this kind of stuff in 2017. There was a spate of arson, and now we're back to arson again. So there are wilder things going on. And that's about as much as I know. In terms of the attacks, I don't think the attacks are any worse than they were. And you must understand that the people are also taking precautions as well. So the attacks, you are getting farmers getting killed, but it's not something that's out of control. It's been worse. It's been worse. So that's as much as I can sum that one up. But there are things that I need to look at more closely. The one instance where a farmer was murdered, and they ended up actually catching the murderers, and then they took them to trial at Senekal. And the whites got there, and the whites were very angry, and the whites even tried to sort of tip over and break into the police van. But the whites have also been putting a lot of pressure on the government and on the police. And just the mere fact that they managed to actually arrest two farm murderers is actually something quite new, because often they just say, well, they can't find them. But I think the ongoing pressure from the different groups is getting more and more intense. The whites are getting more organized, and the Boers are pushing harder. And so they've got bigger audiences, and they are giving the government a harder time over this. So it's not so much a case that the farm murders are that much worse. It's that the Boers are getting more and more organized and are pushing harder and harder. And every farm murder now irritates people a whole lot more than the same thing would have done a year ago or 2 years ago. So that's a bit of background there.
Are you familiar with, you've covered Orania before, which I think is an interesting model for perhaps America. But are you aware that there's like 12, I believe, 12 autonomous zones within Orania that actually are Jewish?
Autonomous zones within Orania that are Jewish?
Yeah, I was surprised to find that out. Is that true?
That I would like to see more information on, because I find that hard to believe. What I can tell you is happening with Orania is Orania has struck a deal with another organization called AfriForum. And AfriForum has got these sort of Afrikaans type people, but they are also linked to Freemasons, and they're friendly to Jews and so forth. So there is a sort of a financial, there is some kind of investment link into Orania that's happened in recent times. But other than that, Orania is still the same place that it always was. You've got hardcore whites who are living there in a whites-only place. And remember, Orania isn't big. So I find it strange when you say there are 12 different areas within Orania.
I did too.
Orania isn't big. Hey? Orania is only about 1,600 people. And I actually want to at some point go to Orania again. I had planned on going to Orania this year, but maybe I'll do it next year. I want to go back there. But I have spoken to people who live in Orania, and I spoke to a guy who lived in Orania a couple of months ago, and I spoke in quite great detail. And he said things were going very well, and even property prices were going up. Whites are doing manual labor and getting well paid. All in all, Orania is doing good stuff. But you must keep in mind, it's a small place. But the number of people moving there is more and more. And Orania is not alone anymore. Orania may be the most well-known, but there are whites starting to set up little communities in all sorts of different places. There's even a place near Pretoria East, which is a which also is kind of a sort of a whites-only place. Then there's a farm on far out on Pretoria West that I've been to, which is a Christian setup for whites. And they also run their own thing as a whites-only thing. So, and then there are also whites I know who are busy with some stuff down in the Cape. They're busy trying to set up like small small setups there. There's also a place where people are buying land. Somebody's gone and bought a farm, and they're going to turn the farm into like a village or a town, and people have been buying there. So there are all kinds of similar kinds of things popping up all over now. So the whites are looking around.
I'm curious, though, where I got that from, actually, Jan, is I read it on Eric Stryker's National Justice website, and he actually wrote a piece on it about how there's 12 autonomous zones that were linked to Jews. you might have to check that for yourself and back up the information, because like sometimes Stryker's right, sometimes he's wrong. It's not always a reliable source, but that's where I got the information from, if you're wondering.
I would suggest that you email me his article afterwards, and then okay. I'll look into it. But Oranje is a small place. It's basically like a piece of land that they bought, and there's only one town there. So, and I got to tell you something else. From the time when I was in Oranje, I find it hard to believe that Jews would be there, because Oranje is so remote. It's so remote. Jews live in urban areas. The Jews in South Africa, most of them live in Johannesburg, and the second biggest population is in Cape Town. To find Jews living in Oranje or in the rural areas, that's not normal for Jews. Oranje is very, very remote. It's a very remote area. And when I was there, I can tell you all those whites are – the whites are Afrikaans because –
Oh, sorry. Let me make the correction. Someone said in the chat that the autonomous zones are not in Oranje. I think, I apologize for that. I think it's that there's 12 autonomous zones in South Africa in general. I was unsure. Someone told me something differently, so I apologize for that.
Okay, that could be. Because there is somebody who has pointed out that Jews may have some place of their own. But you must understand also that these autonomous zones are not truly independent. These are people who have managed to use – basically what they've done in like Oranje and these other places is they've basically figured out a way to have a white – whites only community, and they've managed to do it within the law. Like in the case of Oranje, what they've done is Oranje is a special type of business. So it's a special type of company, and if you want to live in Oranje, you basically have to buy shares in the company. And then Oranje is actually a business. And that is how they managed to get away with it, because then they simply say, well, all the shareholders in this business are allowed to live here. And so we're not stopping black people from being shareholders or whatever. And that is how they kind of twist past it. And these other places are all sort of variations on that theme. Oranje's got the most sophisticated setup. So you can have places where if people have enough money and they've bought a piece of land or they've bought up an area where they then turn it into some kind of thing that they control on some kind of business basis. And I have heard that Jews have got it like a place like that, but I've not dug into it more. But it could be that there are 12 autonomous, let's call it autonomous zones. But just be aware that they're not truly autonomous. They're not like they are outside of the law. That they have to function according to the laws of South Africa, but they are very careful in how they've constructed it, so that it doesn't, so that it's not overtly racist. But in reality, if you go there, you'll find only whites there.
Okay. So, all right. I was unaware of that situation. I just had briefly skimmed through the article. I'm curious about the Senegal incident. Do you know much about that? Because like the news we have over here is that it seemed like there was an insurrection. There's like an Ebor insurrection, and they're now, I believe now I'm reading articles where the government is calling them to be terrorists. There was this proclamation by this what looked like a guy dressed in a general that was talking about the whole incident. Do you know much about that?
I have got a little bit. I can give you some comments on it. What they are referring to as the insurrection is probably the stuff that happened that day in court when the whites came in large numbers, and the whites were basically storming into the building, And the police even were on the run, and the whites were then attacking the police vehicle. There was a police vehicle that had two of the prisoners in it, and the whites were trying to throw this thing over on its side, and they actually did manage to take one of the police vehicles, one of the smaller police vehicles, a police truck, and they did overturn that, and that did catch fire. And I did see film footage where the police were actually throwing stun grenades at the whites. And it was quite funny because the police were in a armored vehicle and they chucked a stun grenade at the whites. And then they raced off away from the whites as if the whites were a threat to them. But those events that day are probably the reason why they have been so, why they've now turned up the heat on the whites. That is the main thing as I understand it. They didn't like the fact that the whites were so, we could call it aggressive, but the whites were pretty much screaming and banging their way into the building. And the police were definitely on their back foot. The black police were afraid of the whites, actually. So I think that is why they're making a bigger thing out of it. And I believe later, I think Julius Malema went to Senekal sometime later with his lot. But I haven't followed it in more detail.
Well, a lot of us in America were like getting our hopes up that that was finally the breaking point for the Boers. And, you know, a lot of us over here that are very politically active, we were maybe under the impression that sort of like there is these opposing views about the Boers and accelerationism, kind of like there is in America. A lot of people here in America want to keep this system afloat. They want to keep it going while at the same time appearing that they are resisting the system on our side. And what is like the climate over there in terms of like, you know, in terms of like accelerationism and also like kind of keeping the system afloat and sort of rebelling against the system?
Okay. In that sense, I'm an accelerationist. I'm actually quite bored with people just kind of carrying on as normal. But the big thing you got to realize about the people here is the people are also very afraid as well. And they are afraid to do things because they're up against the government and we don't have the numbers that you guys have. So there is a lot of fear that exists. So you've got fear on the one hand and anger on the other hand. And there are those people who want to try and move things forward. And in this regard, I can mention things like self-rule. So the notion of, I understand where you're coming from about keeping the system going or letting the system, you know, being an accelerationist and letting it collapse. I have got accelerationist views here, and I'm probably one of the very few that thinks like that, where I say to the people that the more things collapse, the better it is. Let it collapse. That's the only way that we're going to go forward. Now, another thing you got to understand about these people is don't imagine that these people are going to engage in wild violence and they're just going to do it on a whim. They are able to control themselves, and anything that they do, ultimately, they will think it through. The real problem is also that there isn't leadership that is bold enough and brave enough to take us into the path that we should be going to. But what is happening is that lots of the whites on the white right do think in terms of a whites-only country. They do think in those terms. And that deep down, that dream of a Boer state or a whites-only state, that is very real. And it exists even among those who are not openly racist and openly right-wing. There are lots who do think like that in the right wing. But remember, the right wing isn't the majority of the whites. But in the right wing, there are lots of whites who want a true state of their own. They want self-rule, self-government. So that is a big motivation. And mostly what people are looking at is they're saying, you know, how can we get a state? Is it possible to get it? If so, how do we go about getting it, etc.? And then that is where much of the discussion is. But you must, but just like in America, the white right doesn't have money, doesn't have influence. But what you will see, one group that does have a lot of money and influence is, take note of the organization AFRI Forum. AFRI Forum is a organization that is linked to the last white ruler of South Africa, de Klerk. And AFRI Forum, de Klerk and his buddies got in with Jews and everything. And de Klerk's organizations get money. Money does flow to them. And so through his de Klerk Foundation and all that, there is money that flows to AFRI Forum. So AFRI Forum has got these kind of Jewy, Freemason, liberal kind of links. But AFRI Forum has got real money, like real money. Like in Pretoria, they were busy building a university for Afrikaans-speaking people. And they do many things. And they even assist sometimes with the farmers and so forth. But so they've got like the right sentiments, but they're not openly right-wing. And if you listen to them, they will even openly attack white nationalism. They'll attack nationalism as a bad thing. So you've got these sort of funny kinds of Afrikaans people who've got money, but they got to pretend to be liberal. And there are many of them who are liberal, but inside the organization, there are also lots of non-liberals. And AFRI Forum, in that sense, is this sort of moneyed, semi-liberal, semi-Afrikaans organization that can pack a big punch. And AFRI Forum plays an important role in many things. And they are quite a driving force for things. So you get other whites, common whites, who go and work for them, etc. And they are trying in their own way to try and push AFRI Forum also towards doing the things that the Boers really want. So there's a bunch of, let's call it politicking, going on inside AFRI Forum as they think up things. But AFRI Forum is really powerful, and they are the most powerful thing under Afrikaans control in South Africa. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. So AFRI Forum recently announced that it's going to team up with a political party called the Freedom Front Plus, which is also like ex-military, old guys from the previous government. And these two groups are going to have a conference. The conference may even have started already. They're going to have a conference on self-rule, self-government. And that is very important. Now, what I'm not sure, and when the conference is over, I'll find the film footage because I want to listen to the different people. They've got a bunch of professors who are going to be talking there. And in this discussion, they're going to be talking about how feasible is it for us to have self-government and self-rule for the whites. And I personally don't think that they're going to want to push this too hard. But I do welcome the fact that AFRI Forum is pushing it because it's going to reach a bigger audience than ever before. And so with AFRI Forum and the Freedom Front, that is good news because they're not hardcore right. but it's really good news to see those guys getting in, because there are lots of academics and so in there, and I want to hear what they have to say. I suspect that among those people that I've seen on the list who are going to talk, I suspect that on that list, some of those people are not going to be too keen on pushing the idea. They're going to come up and give us more of a list of the problems that can't be solved than solutions. But even so, this is a unique event. And I can't stress enough the importance of this event, because I don't think in 26 years of Black Rule, I don't think that we've ever had something like that. And I know that the event will be also on YouTube and all that. So I did publish, I did mention it on one of my posts. But this is very interesting. So what I'm saying is that whites are moving, but they're moving slowly. And whites are not going to, just break out and go wild. They're not going to do that. You know, if you're going to see somebody going wild, it's going to be a loner type, but it's not going to be the norm.
That's typically what happens. I've noticed the whites are more kind of reserved, but once they gain momentum and once they start, get this momentum going, it tends to explode all at once. That seems to be a concurrent theme with white people throughout the ages when they are being kind of held down by a certain kind of tyranny. If that tyranny kind of it comes from the form of, you know, kind of their own sellouts, or also communists, blacks, Jews, etc. So that seems to be a current theme, as you pointed out. I'm curious, Jan, like on the ground when it comes to the Boer, like how self-sufficient are they? Because here in America, a lot of people want accelerationism in America, but they're not very self-sufficient. They don't have farms set in place. They don't have food sources set in place. So when the government finally does decentralize, becomes decentralized here in America, as it looks like it's doing each year, regardless of who wins elections, there doesn't seem to be a lot of people that are self-sustained, have their own food sources, etc. What about the Boer in terms of like when sort of the government kind of destabilized? I guess it already is in a way. What's the situation with them being self-sustained?
By the way, before I answer, I just quickly went and looked at the article that I posted. This conference has already started, and they are doing every Monday they are having a talk. So they started on Monday, October the 19th. Then on this Monday is going to be the second one. And there are a total of 4 days of these conferences. So I will start finding out what happened on the first one. And it ends on the 9th of November. So I will be looking at that with interest. And when I find it, I'll let you know.
Okay.
But in terms of the farmers, as much as they try to destroy the farmers, the fact of the matter is that the white farmers are still the main force when it comes to feeding the country. And I've noticed that despite all the things that have gone badly, that in actual fact, we've had a good year farming-wise. And as always, whites tend to come through. So there are even some of us who've been talking about groups, about trying to buy food directly from farmers. I know there are some groups that have been formed. I myself am interested in that sort of thing. I think that on the whole, if it comes to food, the white farmers are pretty organized. And most of the food definitely comes from them, and the blacks themselves are dependent on it. So that's why the blacks can't just go and do wild things. because they themselves will be starving to death. So when it comes to self-sufficiency, most people are not self-sufficient, though you have preppers and you have more preppers than you had before. The vast majority of whites here, just like the vast majority of whites elsewhere, are preppers. But because of the nature of life in South Africa, most everybody has learned to some degree to start thinking ahead. And even if it's just buying extra food and things like that. So most people are aware of the problems that are occurring and they try to figure out ways around it, whether it is electricity, etc. Like with the power outages, for example, which they say are going worse. If I look in my own suburb, most of the people in the street I live in don't have either solar power and they don't have generators. But you can see more and more people doing that, and it is definitely increasing. But it requires, you know, people really need to literally have bullets flying past their heads before they start doing things. And that is another reason why I'm a total accelerationist. I can tell you that there are going to be people who aren't even going to be worried about things until they actually see the bullets flying every day. And that's the only time that they'll actually do something. But whites tend to be quite practical in South Africa, and they do manage to get a lot of things done. Like in fighting crime, for example. Crime is not such a big thing because people have learned to do all the different things that you need in order to protect yourself. So if they'd not done that, we would have been slaughtered. But generally speaking, things are not too bad. And the only thing that's stopping it from being bad is us. It's our ability to prepare. You know, people have just taken all the security precautions that they can. So I think in the event that we were to have food problems, you would probably find that farmers would be able to just start selling in bulk and people would go and get food from them. It would probably work that way. And we are moving more and more towards that. Like the one place where I buy food from a Portuguese sort of wholesaler that buys directly from farmers. So that is how I get cheap, some cheaper food. So that's as best as I can answer it.
Okay, that's good to hear. Let's go. This is a really kind of left field question, Jan. I'm curious, though. Is it true that some of the Bantu groups actually are supporting the Boers, like the Zulu? Is that true?
There has been discussion along those lines on and off for many years, even going back to the 1980s. There was talk of the Zulus in particular. The Zulus originally, of all the blacks, the Zulus originally resisted the communists the most. But later on, one of the Zulus, Zuma, he became a commie and he managed to win over the majority of the Zulus onto becoming commies and joining up with the ANC. But for a long time, they resisted communism and so forth. In fact, the German government even supported the Zulus in South Africa in the 1960s, can you believe? But ultimately, I want to tell you that when it comes to non-white groups, the group that I think will end up being the closest one to supporting the whites will be the colored people, the mixed race people, the ones who are half white, half black. They are going to be the closest that we're going to have to non-white allies. And my own thinking is that in the end, you'll find that the blacks will stick together more or less against the whites. It will ultimately be racial. But the colored people, The colored people don't see themselves as black, and they see themselves as superior. They see themselves as superior to the blacks, and they see themselves as being closer to the whites. And so a thought that I have, that I'm convinced that this is the way it's going to go, is that the more whites work for their own independence and work for their own groups, the more you will see the other groups start doing the same. And if the whites were to eventually break free in some way, then you'll find that the coloreds will want to break free. And in the history of the Boers, there have been times where the coloreds have teamed up with the Boers and fought the blacks and defeated them. That has happened in the past, in the distant past. So that's as best I can, best insight I can give you. So, I think the only thing that can change this country is whites.
Yeah,
and that is why Jews and liberals are freaked out, man. They must be freaking out as they see whites starting to talk all these other kinds of talk. They are freaking out. They never expected this, but it's coming.
Go ahead, Jan. Sorry. Go ahead.
There is something I forgot to mention to you. I forgot to mention secession.
Yes.
Secession over and above self-determination, which is basically heading towards a whites-only state or some kind of white self-rule inside South Africa. The other possibility is outright secession. Now, the South African Constitution does make provision for that. The whites did get that into the Constitution. So just like your country, we also have the notion that you can secede. But of course, as you know from your civil war, even when you're allowed to secede, it's not to say that the other side will abide by the rules. But be that as it may, in South Africa, there is quite a strong secession movement run by a rather strange fellow. His surname is Marx, Hein Marx. So there could be a little bit of Jewy weirdness in there. But this Hein Marx was an official from the previous government, and he's gone through the process. He knows the proper process to follow for secession. And in order to secede, the piece of territory that he wants to break away from South Africa is the Western Cape. The Western Cape is quite a dry, miserable area. It's like Orania, maybe even worse. But it's also an area where the whites have got a bigger percentage of the population. Like in South Africa, whites make up 9% of the whole population. But in the Western Cape, we make up 17%. And in the Western Cape, there are lots of coloreds. And so what Hein Marx is doing is he's trying a multiracial attempt at secession. And in order to actually get secession, I think he needs 2 million votes. And he's already got 360,000 people supporting him. So he's got the biggest movement in the country that is moving towards legal secession. And so even though his thing is a multiracial thing, though of course underneath it all, most of the movers and shakers and people interested in it are the whites, the fact is he is also pushing forward. And that is a separate thing to the initiative by AfriForum and the Freedom Front. But it's also a very important move. And I'm very glad to see that thing gaining ground. There's a lot more talk of the Cape or parts of the Cape seceding. And I must tell you that when I started my activism 20 years ago, I didn't see these kinds of things at that time, though I myself mentioned the idea that the Cape should whites should seize the Cape and break away with it. And that does seem to be, that is definitely gaining momentum. I even know whites who've moved to the Cape in order to be away from Johannesburg, etc. So this kind of talk of secession and self-rule and stuff, this is very good, very healthy. And we've never had it on the scale that we've got it now.
Somebody in the chat actually said, mentioned that about the Marx secession movement. And they're saying that the first thing that they ever did was they got kind of Jewish investors on board, and then they kind of, I guess they promoted the multiculturalism. What do you say about that?
That is very, very likely, because a lot of those people who are involved in that are also very Afrikaans, Jew-friendly kind of people. You see, what I like about these things is that at least it's a step in the direction of breaking away. And the truth of the matter with these things is that the real people driving it are whites. And they are, you see, if they said that they wanted to break away in a whites-only state, then that would be a no-no. The government would be on their case, etc. So just like with Orania and all these other things, the whites are trying to do things in ways that do not break the law. That's the key thing. Because if they do illegal stuff, they're going to get into trouble. So they're trying to sort of skirt around it and do it in this way. I personally don't think any of these things, I don't think these things are likely to fully succeed, but I do like the direction, and it gives the whites a chance to play the game rather than sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. I'm all in favor of them doing things, even if it's not exactly the right thing. Because we still have to see if they can get to the point where they can secede. Because I believe that even if they try to secede with a multicultural, multiracial thing, that even if they did get there, that the government will still resist it. So it will be very interesting to see how far they get. And what I want to see is I want to see them actually get to that point and then see if the government starts tricking them, cheating them, threatening them, etc. Because it could still be an interesting twist that might allow us some freedom of action without breaking the law openly. Because you got to understand, if we want to have our own country, we literally going to have to go to war over it. And I've made this clear to people all along, that ultimately, if we want to do our own thing, we got to know that we're going to have to rebel, just like you and I spoke before the show about the Rhodesian Rebellion against Britain. The Rhodesian Rebellion is illegal. It's like the American Rebellion of 1776. When you rebel, then the answer is going to be that the government's going to send the army to attack you. They're going to send the army to attack you, the police to arrest you, and the only way that you're going to manage to hang in there is you're going to have weapons and troops, and you're going to have to fight the army. You're going to have to fight the army, fight the police, fight the government. And this at least allows them to engage in moves and go through the processes and start making headway on the notion of how do you become independent, and to do it without breaking the law. But my own feeling is that the time will come in the chaos that lies ahead, that the time will come where we need to break the law. So it's quite fine, as far as I'm concerned, it's quite fine. Let's go down the path of legal secession. And then we see when we get there, is it going to work? Or do we then have to break the law and rebel at that point in time? And this may be a good way to get to that point But to get to that point without breaking the law and getting in jail or getting killed before then. So I don't have a problem with the concept because it gets us closer to where we want to go. And later on, when we are really close, then you can maybe even take that thing and throw it out the window and say, you know, this is what we really want to do, and off you go. It all just depends on how we organize our leadership at that time. And I will tell you as well that when it comes to Jews and money and blacks and money, the money stuff is not working in South Africa and it's falling apart. And even the Jewish population of South Africa has dropped a lot. I was reading in recent months that the population of Jews in South Africa is now given as 52,000. At their highest peak, officially the highest peak of Jews was 120,000. But I remember speaking to a Jew who told me that at its peak it was 180,000. So large numbers of Jews have left under black rule. And in news stories in the Jewish media, the Jews who are still here have been saying that many of them are going to leave still. So, you know, once the economy falls apart, as it is doing, the Jews go. Jews are not going to be, there are going to be very few Jews who are going to be around when we get to the point of actual racial conflict. So a lot of these things where people think that the money is always going to be there, I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, when the going gets tough, and I've seen this even with other non-whites, eh? I've seen this with colored people that live in the same suburb as me. I've noticed that just the slightest bit of economic hardship, and some of these colored people jump on a plane and they go and they work overseas. And they've got houses and stuff that they own here. There's a colored lady who lives not far from me, and she owns like five houses. But she goes and she works in Ireland, and she prefers to stay in Ireland. And these non-whites, you know, when it comes to, let's call it the shit hitting the fan time,
yeah.
I want to tell you that, and this is going to be true in your country, when the shit hits the fan, lots of Jews will be gone. Lots of liberals will jump on planes. You may even find some of your blacks even running away. If you guys are in a race war, don't be surprised to find some of your blacks running away. I want to tell you that when the shit hits the fan, the people who are going to be the people who will have the best cohesion and who will still be around will be whites.
Yes.
So white people are very hard. White people are very, very hard to scare off. Very hard. And they defend their homes and their territory. It's a natural part of our people. I can tell you, people, that is why people who think that whites are just going to flee from South Africa to America, let's all just go to America. It's not going to happen that way. I'll tell you when we'll go to America. We'll first fight a war, and if we lose the war, then the survivors might go to America. But that's how whites are. That is how whites always are. Before they run, they're going to fight.
Well, let me ask you, Jan, how do you feel about the Boers that are maybe fleeing from South Africa, going to places like Russia or Australia or to even America or the United Kingdom? How do you feel about them?
That's an interesting question. I used to sit and ponder these things and wonder, is it good? Is it bad? There's always, it's not all negative. One of the things about them is that even when they leave, they do remember us. So even when they leave, they do stay in touch. I've got white people, like the other day on one of my groups, a white lady who lives in London from South Africa. She joined one of my groups because she wanted to find out how things are going here. And they've got family. So even if they leave, they've still got family here. And they don't ever quite totally leave mentally. So it's not like they leave and they forget about us and they're gone. Wherever they go, they are going to talk about South Africa. And in that sense, those who leave also form something of a diaspora for us. And so it does have its benefits in that sense. I do think that if the shit hits the fan, there may even be some who might come back to help, but they will definitely help from afar. And another thing is that not that many are leaving. Like those going to Russia, I'd like to see some numbers of how many actually have gone to Russia, because I personally have never heard or known of anybody who's left to go to Russia.
Well, I just remember, Jan, that I think the Russian government was offering partials for plots of land for South Africaners, Boers, to settle there. That's all I know about it. That's why I mentioned it.
That's true. But the question is how many of the whites are going to go there. I don't think it will be large numbers. I think at most you're going to be looking at it. At most, a few dozen. And so there have been others who've left. There are still whites who are leaving, just as there are Jews who are leaving. But the rate at which they're leaving isn't that great, because the people who are left are also the poorer people. The people who had lots of money, they have already, those who had lots of money and better jobs and the ability to move, they fled long ago. And you must know, whites have been leaving South Africa for the last 30 years. Whites were leaving South Africa even in the 1980s. And then we've also had a small inflow. We also have a small inflow of whites from Europe, can you believe? So we have had new whites coming in from Europe, not many, but especially Eastern Europe. So I don't like it that they're leaving, but I'm not going to say that they're traitors, and I'm not going to say that it's totally bad. I think there is a good side to it, and that it's important for us, for our survival. It is critically important. You must know, South Africa used to be a very closed society, and we didn't have links outside the country. And we didn't have our own diaspora. We didn't have a media. Now we've got a bit of our own media and our ability to tell our story and to have a diaspora. So our ability to link to whites outside South Africa is actually very important, critically important. If we stop having links with guys like you and others who are doing shows, that could be the end of us. So I don't see it totally as a negative, and you never know what benefits can come from having whites who are overseas and established if the shit hits the fan and we truly need all kinds of assistance. We now have people overseas who are citizens in other countries. We can maybe pull some strings that we couldn't do before. So I don't think it's all negative.
You know, that's interesting you mentioned that, Jan. I've often wondered if since the censorship here in America, we still have, of course, our constitutional rights, but increasingly the digital censorship and kind of the ostracization of, you know, being ostracized in like everyday life here in America has become kind of a burden, where they take away your income and your way to live. I'm curious, though, if like it would be strategic for many of the white Americans maybe to voluntarily start making expat sort of communities, isolated sort of expat communities in other regions that maybe have ways to make businesses in like these particular regions, and funnel that money into like starting like media for our guys, kind of like Rob Rundo is doing in Serbia. And in Eastern, and other people are probably doing in Eastern Europe, What do you think about this concept as a strategy for fighting sort of the media censorship, which is, and also like earning potential income, from having very controversial views?
Yeah, and our views are only controversial because Jews and liberals have made them controversial or claimed that they are controversial. Our views 40 and 50 years ago would not be anywhere nearly as controversial, you know, as they apparently are now. But when you say forming expat communities for Americans, are you talking about communities outside America?
Yes.
I know of some Americans who went to South America. Where else are you seeing expat communities?
Well,
of
like
Americans?
Places like Eastern Europe, like, and I'm not saying that, like, if it's possible, like, because the way I see it is that the Jews are playing an international game with us. They are playing an international game, so this is why we have to be sort of international ourselves.
Absolutely.
We have to cut them off, you know, wherever we can internationally. And the way I look at it is that the media here, it's very easy for me to, like, have this, you know, thing on the internet. But to reach, like, expansive amounts of people, you have to go out of America to get the message that white Americans, their numbers are decreasing, and we're kind of under this kind of tyranny. This like invisible tyranny, where sort of like, you know, we have freedom of speech, we have the right to, you know, voice about our interest, but like I said, our income is going to be stricken from us because of our views. And you're right, our views weren't controversial, but I'm talking about like sort of forming expat communities as a way to work around sort of the financial problem, and that like you have these various different like businesses. And you have even media outlets in other places which are sympathetic to pro-whites in America.
Okay. I just wanted to get some clarity a bit because I was just curious where the expat communities were. But okay, I fully understand. I am all in favor of that. Absolutely, totally and utterly. 110% with it. It's something that Alex Linda and I have also, we've discussed things privately as well, where we've talked to each other and we've said, you know, we really need to do things and how are we going to get things done. And Alex has said, you know, if there's one thing the white right needs, it's money. And because Jews make sure,
yes,
you know, Jews kill the small guy by ruining him financially. And if they can't get you driven out of your job, they as one of my other supporters commented, he said, you know, Jews will also destroy you through the process, you know, by throwing people into courts and things like that. And the costs that you've got to incur that are just too much for you. You know, they bankrupt you through the process. So even if the process doesn't destroy, even if the courts don't destroy you, the process of going through the courts will destroy you. You know, eventually you'll run out of money, et cetera. And the first thing that they attack, I've always seen, is the first thing they go for is money. You know, I was deplatformed off YouTube. I was deplatformed off Google AdWords. You know, the moment that they saw people on the white right moving to Google ads and things, they just started a slow, long process until eventually you had virtually nothing. And they are very active and very proactive and very aggressive. The moment they see the slightest little issue, they go after the whites ruthlessly. So I do like the idea of expat communities. I do like the idea of whites. I do like the idea of whites mixing because it's very healthy. And later I want to do some – I did a bunch of reading earlier this year that I haven't put into videos yet. But I studied Professor Carol Quigley quite seriously earlier this year, And Quigley is a very fascinating American. And he was actually a kind of a liberal and an insider and so forth. But among Quigley's things that he did was he was a lecturer on civilization. And he gave a lecture at Georgetown University, a course in the rise and fall of civilizations. Now, Quigley isn't really one of our friendly guys, but I wanted to know how the elite think. And among the things that came out of studying his stuff about civilization, and I do think that he also had a couple of errors in there, but he generally had some pretty good stuff. One of the points that he spoke about a civilization forming is the mixing of people. And I want to tell you that all this trouble that is occurring all across the Western world that is causing whites to leave one country and go to another country. If you look around, you'll see that there are lots of whites who left Europe and went to America. Now, for the first time, you're seeing Americans leaving America. And you've got South Africans and Rhodesians and Portuguese and all kinds of others who've moved around. This moving around of white people, you've also got the end results of World War II, where you've had Germans moving to South America. There were even Germans and Italians who moved to South Africa. I want to tell you that these things that are causing whites to move around and to live in other countries with other whites and to deal with each other, and our media and us talking to each other in different countries, I want to tell you that I think this is the healthiest thing of all. And this thing, when I look at the lessons of Quigley on civilization, I want to tell you that I think we whites are still going to form the new civilization. He had rules for civilization that he mentioned, and I'm not going to go into it here. But this mixing of people, moving around of people, and this results in not just the physical mixing of people, but also, more importantly, the mixing of information and culture and our interest in European culture and learning from each other and so forth. This mixing that's busy going on, out of this is going to come something huge. And if you look at the end of World War I, you'll see that the pain and suffering and hassles of World War I led to the creation of new lines of thinking, fascism and National Socialism. And that came out of the pain and suffering of World War I. And look at how many of us have moved towards National Socialism, racialism, etc. And this is a direct result of the internet and of the instability of our times. I regard it as very healthy, and I totally agree that all of us must interact as closely as possible with each other. And the more ties we can have with each other, cultural ties, ties of friendship, intermarriage, business, all these things are going to lead to new good things. And the beautiful thing that I see coming out of this is all whites realizing that we're the same and similar, and we're starting to probably for the first time in our history, maybe even, starting to actually see us needing each other instead of seeing each other as competition and fighting each other. I think this is huge.
I think
go for it.
Go ahead, John. Finish it.
Yeah, so for me, I am all in favor of that. And I want to tell you something else, that in order to form a country, this is why I also think that liberalism isn't going to fly. Multiracialism isn't really going to fly. Ultimately, when push comes to shove, you're going to see that people are going to stick together on the basis of race eventually.
Yeah.
It will eventually boil down to that. And building those bonds is very, very important. And if you study, I'm almost finished, and if you study warfare and you look at whites who fought, you will see that people bond together. People bond together the most when they are struggling and fighting. That is when the real bonds between people are formed. And those bonds are invaluable, absolutely invaluable. Then you become brothers in arms, blood brothers, and that changes everything. We will never again see each other and mock each other from a distance and laugh at each other's failings. As it is, we've all been brought closer together and we worry about each other. And this is excellent stuff. Excellent.
Are you familiar with Francis Perkiyaki's Imperium? Are you familiar with that book?
Man, I know about it, but it's on a long list of books yet to be read. So I've not. But you're welcome. You go ahead and tell me some
Yaki,
of the thoughts.
Yaki is a very controversial figure in these circles. He's quite an elusive figure, and people can't seem to pinpoint his political philosophy. But he kind of follows the line of Spengler, and you know, his kind of flow of civilization, and dovetails a lot of what you were talking about in terms of like white imperium. He wanted to strengthen ties between Europeans against America, whom he saw as sort of a vassal state for the Jews. He saw the American power at the time exerting a lot of dominance upon the German people at Nuremberg, and he noticed this when he was an attorney deliberating over the Nuremberg trials and going over sort of like the Nuremberg trials. So like he saw this as a America sort of as, you know, what we'd call ZOG, you know, Zionist Occupied Government, and they saw it as a threat to Europe, and that it was promoting a lot of decadent and cultural distortion to the rest of the world. He made a lot of controversial alliances, which people don't agree with. And he thought by doing so, he could preserve the white race and also preserve Europeans. That's all I'll say here about Yaki. I'll let you further look into him and his life. But a lot of people, you know, just, I guess they think he's sort of he's a very controversial figure. That's all I'll say. And like he would be aligned with what you're talking about in terms of like, you know, this kind of union of Europeans and white Americans and other European groups kind of forming together against this kind of globalist sort of Jewish presence everywhere. And my primary point for doing so is kind of to combat the propaganda and media that is prevalent everywhere regarding whites, because they are spreading the cultural Marxism. They are spreading the sort of critical race theory. They're spreading all kinds of cancerous thoughts about white people and white supremacy everywhere on this globe and this planet that I think should be combated. You know, it should be combated with our kind of media sources. And I think that's the most important breakthroughs we need to do to not overcome digital censorship, but also to try to propel our message globally across the world and to other whites. And yes, even forming expat communities in European nations and also in white nations all throughout the globe. And by the way, that includes like white communities. Like even in South America, there are white communities. I want to say it's not only exclusive to the Anglosphere or even to Europe. We got communities all over the planet, and I think these could be mobilized just the way the Jews try to mobilize the non-whites against us.
I like what you're saying, and I totally agree, you know, that we're in a global war, and for the first time ever, common whites can take on the Jews by using our diaspora and our spread across the world. And I'm 100% with you on this. And yeah, it will be very good. You know, the Western world is really the white world. And, you know, we need to bring ourselves closer. I am a believer in like pan-European nationalism. I believe we should form a bloc of our own racially. That is very important, so that we don't do the kinds of things that we did in the past, where we do these terrible, terrible things that destroyed Europe and, you know, caused all the problems that it caused and killed all the people that it killed needlessly. You know, I think this is why I think in many ways it's good even that Americans are having problems. Because if somebody feels that they don't have a problem, then they'll just carry on as usual. But the fact that things are now stressful, this is causing change. And on this media thing, I totally agree with the media. I agree we should be operating totally, closely in all sorts of ways. Even to the point of some Jews steal from whites in one country and they jump on a plane and go to another country. We just send messages to our guys in the other country and say, hey, those Jews that stole from us, they're over there by you. Go take care of them, kind of thing. And Trump, also, I saw a news report about Trump running the story of having a sort of a Trump media. The media is the biggest thing that the Jews have got that is really smashing us.
Yes.
And I like anything that goes against, even if it's mild like Trump stuff. But the fact is Trump by himself, even just using Twitter and I think he uses Instagram as well. I mean, he's got a huge following. And his ability to just spit in the face, you know, in that sense, I like Trump because he's the first president anywhere in the Western world who just spits in the face of the media. And he openly tells them that they are lying and he talks about fake news. I think that is the healthiest thing that's ever happened. I think it's fantastic. And even if we can break that monopoly, that is where the real battle is. And that's why these Jews are shutting down everything. I mean, Facebook shutting down all discussion about the Holocaust, and these things. That should show you we are winning. We are winning. They can't even control Facebook anymore. And I like that. I noticed that even before this, I noticed that even after years of working against people on Facebook, I noticed that people, whites, were still able to get messages across. Whites are getting so good at guerrilla warfare, and we're getting better and better at this.
I think they call it four-generational warfare.
Yeah, well, I think it's excellent. We have to build up these things, and if we can solve the problem of businesses and jobs and sharing of things in that sense, that is huge. I have also been sitting and thinking about financial stuff myself. I have been talking to people about it quietly, and we have been exchanging ideas on it. It is definitely a must. I don't think we're going to become billionaires out of it, but the point is to rather have something. You know, when I was younger, they used to say, oh, well, you know, you've got to be professional in your job and you mustn't talk about religion and you mustn't talk about politics. Well, I'm now of the opinion that, you know what, I don't want to function in that mode anymore. I want to function in a mode where the business that I do is racial. It must be racial. It must be political. I think that is what we need to be making sure that the things that we are doing are not just purely for money, that it does have an actual link to our existence and our stuff. The more that we can be racial in everything we do, the better it's going to be. And it will totally freak out the Jews, man. They'll go crazy. They do it all the time. But if we were to play the game even to 10% of the level they do, they'll lose their minds. They will hate it.
Just a side question somebody asked in the chat, and I'm now addressing. Yes, I'm going to address you guys' question. I just my time is limited here, and there's so much to talk about. It's just I can't fit everything in here. But let me get to this question. Somebody asked about an organization in South African history called the AWB. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I'm pretty familiar with the AWB, yes. The AWB was basically, in its day, it was the biggest right-wing organization, and it was run by Eugene Tiblange. And it's quite a sad story because it shows also how the Jews were even fooling the whites back then. It was that in South Africa in the 1970s, 1980s, you had this guy, Eugene Tiblange, who formed this organization, the AWB, which was basically a militia brown shirts type of organization. And although he, at various times, there were times when he distanced himself from Hitler, but there were aspects of it that had a bit of a swastika type of a look to it, etc. The AWB in its day was the biggest right-wing organization in South Africa, and it was basically aimed at the common man, and it was very successful. At its peak, it had about 900,000 members, and you could say that it was South Africa's brown shirts. And this AWB, these were the whites who were willing to fight a race war against the blacks even then. And there were large numbers of people who joined the AWB. However, under apartheid, the government also had friendly relations with Israel, and Jews were also playing an ever bigger role in South Africa. And the government of the time was basically trying to stay away from open racial conflict. Even the Rhodesian government ran into this problem. Even the Portuguese ran into this problem. And it's all got to do with economics. So whites in Southern Africa, even when they are facing a racial conflict, could not fully mobilize on a totally racial basis. So you had the military and the government and the police and the spies, and there were times when they worked against the white right wing. And there was a time when that white right wing wanted to get violent, but it didn't go as far as it could have gone. It didn't even come close to its potential because the government had already determined that it can't let this thing become fully racial. And that, I'm afraid, was a weakness of the time. Rhodesians suffered from it, and even the Portuguese suffered from it. But that's because you are running a country and you've got large numbers of blacks who are your workers. And so you can't go and openly just slaughter them. But that is what the AWB types of people wanted to do. However, in the future, now that we've lost so much and we are more and more on our own, I believe that the time will come for those kinds of organizations. And that kind of thinking will return, definitely. Yeah, so that's just a bit of
that's background. Interesting you mentioned that. I noticed that the Boer flag is kind of a swastika flag. Is that correct? Is that the Boer flag?
That's not the Boer flag. Oh, that's okay. The AWB flag. The Boer flag is red, green, and blue.
Okay.
But that was that thing. One of the things that I still will do, I was working on it, and I'll just warn you about it now. The influence of the Jews in South Africa under apartheid, in the early days of apartheid, the original whites who started apartheid in 1948, they were anti-Jew. They were against the Jews. And then as time went by, the Jews got in on this thing and broke this thing up. And a critical thing that I have been working on a video, but it's you mentioned you liked the 5-hour video about the Portuguese. Well, I've been working on a video on a set of videos that's much longer than that, which have to do with exactly this issue of the Jews and also the death of Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd. It's the only time ever in the history of Southern Africa that a white leader was assassinated. And the untold story in that is the story of the Jews. And that is, I was doing a lot of work on it, and I want to finish it. And so keep an eye open for it. When you understand the role of the Jews in the death of Verwoerd, then you'll understand why it was that as time went by, the Jews gained more and more influence and apartheid became more and more liberal. But the original apartheid guys were fighting against that tooth and nail. And one of the secrets that I will tell you is that Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, who was killed, was a closet National Socialist. And the Jews knew they had a real enemy in this man. And that's why they set out with every ounce of effort they could to get rid of him. And eventually they did. They tried to kill him twice. They didn't waste time on him. They wanted him fucking dead. He was the greatest guy who led South Africa. He's a fantastic man. And interestingly enough, he wasn't a Boer. Do you know, he was actually Dutch. He was born in Holland, but his dad felt very sorry for the Boers in the Boer War. And when the Boer War was over, he moved to South Africa. And this Dutchman with this friendliness and support for the Boers, his son later on went on to become the Prime Minister of South Africa. And Verwoerd also worked extremely hard, totally racially. He did his utmost to bring the Afrikaans and the English South Africans together. And he openly said that South Africa belongs to all the whites. And so he was a fantastic man. He was the greatest leader this country's ever had. Probably the greatest white leader who ever ruled in all of Africa. So fantastic man, and I've got lots to say about him.
You know, I think it's funny that a Dutchman actually took the white people's side this time. I find that funny because it seems like they have a history of sort of a covering for the Jews historically. Them and the, I hate to say it, but the Anglos as well. I don't want to cause any derision there, but there is a lot of covering of the Dutch and the Anglos for the Jews.
Totally, totally correct. Totally correct. And I think also the Dutch in World War II, you had quite a contingent of Dutch. I think 100,000 Dutch joined the Waffen-SS. And I think that that we may be seeing some moves, maybe the Dutch break away also from the Jew control.
That's good.
But the Jew control is at its worst in the Anglo world.
Yes.
The English, you know, the English speaking side, our race has been cut into between the English speaking part of our race and the Europeans. And the Jews have managed to co-opt the English speakers far too much. It's terrible, actually. But like, look at like the Rhodesians. The Rhodesians believed so much in Britain. You know, the Rhodesians where I come from, they were mostly British. They so believed in Britain until Britain knifed them in the back. And when Britain knifed them in the back, then they started changing. And they also never really forgave Britain. And, you know, this is how you mature. This is how things change. And I think out of all these things, I personally do not see anything bad, even in wars. There are some things that just have to be done. And even with the pain and the suffering, there are lessons that come out of it, and it leaves a mark on history. And in that sense, even though Hitler lost, Hitler made an impression, and he made an impression so deeply, he burned his impression into the soul of the world. And nobody will ever be able to forget Hitler. And in that sense, that is good. So no matter how much the Jews want to destroy Hitler, they can't destroy the memory of Hitler. He and his people burned their image into the history books, and it cannot be removed. And that is going to look at how that has helped us in more recent times, you know, how we are learning from them. So I don't regard anything as a waste. Even the Rhodesian Rebellion, the South African Wars, even the things that we lose, I no longer regard these things as like a waste, because I know that the legacy of history continues onwards. And as long as we have the books and we have the information, we can always learn such valuable lessons from those people. So I don't believe that anything is wasted. Even death is not wasted.
I'm curious, like during apartheid, how much involvement, and also like in the present state, how much involvement did the Nation of Israel have into the apartheid state and to the greater South Africa? How much involvement did they have there? Because this is often used as a strike against apartheid South Africa. So I'm wondering, the Jews are also known for playing both sides and kind of using their Israel as a proxy internationally, you know. So what do you think about that? And are there like any Zionist involvement in like any right wing organizations? And what is your comment on that?
Okay. The thing you got to remember about the whites at the time, especially with Rhodesia and even South Africa to a lesser extent, was isolation, world isolation and sanctions. And the British, for example, put Rhodesia under total economic sanctions, meaning that we couldn't trade with anybody at all. And so that is a big thing that hits you. However, it also has its benefits, because it forces you to develop industry, which is the – so in the short term, you get hit by sanctions, but in the long term, if you are a creative white, as the Germans were, as the whites of Southern Africa were, then in the long term, you can actually benefit from it. But of course, – when you are busy fighting a war and you need things immediately, you can't wait for 10 years. So a thing that the whites of the time struggled with, and South Africa, this is also why South Africa had to, the whites of Southern Africa, let me just return to the issue of, like with that Angola thing, the whites of Southern Africa had to play a very careful game order not to make all the blacks rebel against them. Because in essence, we were whites who were ruling a multicultural state, a multiracial state. And so we were like an elite ruling our slaves. And we had to be careful to not collapse our economies And so the economic factors were very big. And in South Africa's case, South Africa was an enormous producer of gold, and gold especially. And South Africa walked a very fine line in order to not be cut off totally from the world. But South African whites were preparing for more hardship to come. And they were preparing for a future where they might be totally isolated. But it's a very difficult thing to go down that path. You know, if you Americans wanted to isolate yourselves, it's much easier because there's 200 million whites. But when you're just a smaller group of whites and you're dependent on blacks, you've got to play a very careful game. So that is something that you, that people who look at our wars from that time, you've got to keep that in mind, that whites were employing large numbers of blacks, and we couldn't just go and slaughter them because that would then open us up to open face-to-face racial conflict like happened in the early part of that early time in Angola. So the whites played a careful diplomatic game, and the crux of the diplomatic game was to try and retain control of the country without collapsing it, because we don't have enough numbers, especially in Rhodesia, where we were 250,000. We don't have enough numbers to, and we're not in a position yet to just fight the blacks by ourselves. That kind of thinking, we were still very much in dependency thinking. We need those people. We got to keep them happy to a certain extent. So South Africa, therefore, had walked a fine line and tried to do their racial stuff as subtle, in as subtle a manner as they could. So in those times with the Soviet, so what we had was we had the Soviet bloc, which was Russia, China, and all their allies, which included many countries in Africa, on the one side attacking us. Then we had the Western world, on the other hand, who were not willing to really help us, except for some of the Europeans. But the Anglo-American world didn't want to touch us. So the whites had to try and figure out how they were going to survive. And one of the things that the whites of South Africa did at the time was they were looking for alliances with countries. We were like the pariahs. And so they were looking for other countries that we could align with. And they found some allies. For example, apartheid South Africa was closely aligned to Taiwan. Taiwan, which is the original Chinese before the communists. We also had good relations with Japan. We also were very close to Chile. Chile was a big friend. And so in this time of pariahs, Israel was then brought up as being a pariah nation, and that we could work with this pariah nation, and that is where the whole Israel thing comes from. Now, the exact extent of Israel's influence, my own reading and assessment is, like I've said to you, when the original group of whites created apartheid, they set out to be anti-Semitic. But there were also some Christians among them. The original leader was a guy called D.F. Malan. And D.F. Malan was a pastor, and he was actually originally sort of anti-Jewish. But the moment that Israel came into being, D.F. Malan suddenly got all weak-kneed and acknowledged the existence of Israel. Now, after Malan, there was another guy, Strydom, and then came Favurt. Now, you'll find that the Jews attack Favurt the most. Malan, Strydom, and Favurt are the three guys who are the three leaders, or the three prime ministers who basically created apartheid. But of them, the guy who did the most, the guy that everybody says did the most to create apartheid, to create separate racial identities and stuff, was Verwoerd. And so that was sort of the high point of the anti-Jewish time in South Africa, was with Verwoerd. But Verwoerd was killed in the late 60s, 66 or 67. And from then onwards, you'll find that the Jewish influence comes in more and more and more. And that is where Israel eventually comes in. And eventually, right at the end, South Africa was buying missiles from Israel, etc. And from what I can understand, probably the most important weapon that we got from the Israelis were ballistic missiles. Other than that, they did have other things that they brought. I haven't dug enough into it. What I will tell you also is a misconception. Is there was the belief that nuclear stuff in South Africa came from Israel. That is not true. All the nuclear stuff in South Africa comes from France. And France is the country, of all the countries in the world who helped the whites of Southern Africa, the French are the country that helped the whites of Southern Africa the most. France helped all of us massively, especially South Africa. And South Africa's nuclear technology is French. The French built our nuclear reactors. And the French and some of the Europeans were much friendlier to us than the Anglo world. The Anglos did nothing to assist us. But the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Italians, the West Germans, the French, those sort of southern to central and southern Europeans were the ones who were the friendliest to us and traded with us and helped us. But the French by far the most. We bought all the best weapons we got from the French. But the Jews were there, and the Jews became a bigger and bigger thing by the 1980s. And towards the end, and one of the things that kind of messes South Africa up is these Boers who are Christians, who believe that they are Hebrews, and, so the Bible, and, these are the people of the book. And so that is a weakness in South Africa. But that is as much as I can sort of tell you. I do know that the Jews were sneaking around trying to get nuclear stuff out of us. One of my friends worked in a nuclear plant, but he told me that for the most part, they kept the Jews out and so forth. But Israel was here, and the Jews became, from the 70s especially onwards, the Jews became a bigger and bigger influence, and you'll find that the whites became more and more liberal until they were so liberal that they said apartheid's wrong, we've got to hand over the country, etc. The Jewish influence eventually seeps into everyone's mind and messes them up, and then it's game over.
The question is, Jan, how do we stop the Jewish infiltration of right-wing and pro-white organizations? Because this seems to be a recurrent theme. They even, infiltrate the most extreme of the most extreme, white nationalist, organizations or things you wouldn't expect, such as even George Lincoln Rockwell's, organization had people like Dan Burrows and Frank Collin, who somehow got in there. And this has seemed to be a recurrent theme, that Jews are experts at being chameleons and infiltrating even the most of so-called counter-Semitic environments. And also another question before you go into that, I don't mean to bombard you with questions. Was there any CIA or an American intelligence involvement with apartheid South Africa? Or is – go ahead.
Okay, let's hit the CIA first. Actually, South Africa had South Africa tried very hard to be on the good side of America. The South Africans did their utmost to try and work with the United States. They were really hoping that the United States, that because the blacks were funded by communists, they were hoping really hard that America would get involved. Even in Rhodesia, we always used to say, look at the people we are fighting against. They are funded and armed by the same people who are arming the Vietnamese. You know, the Russians and the Chinese who were arming up the Vietnamese, the North Koreans, the Cambodians, all of those same people were also arming up the blacks and working against us. So the whites really were quite concerned at why doesn't America come to help us? We are fighting communism. We're fighting the same enemy that you're fighting in Vietnam. And South Africa, especially as the regional power, was doing its utmost to work with the United States. And I will tell you that it appears to me from various testimony from military and intelligence people who worked here in South Africa and who wrote their biographies and so forth afterwards, they do point out on a number of occasions, times when the CIA was friendly to them, even helped them, even gave them tip-offs, etc. So they were trying very hard, and they did feel that they were getting some kind of support. But politically, there was no support. I tend to form the view that military and intelligence people have got their feet more firmly planted on firmer racial ground than politicians. And the military people generally have a softer spot for racial people than others. But the truth is that your government never really supported us, etc. And I think from an American strategic point of view, America probably looked at us and said, you're such small territories, you will never be able to survive. And what is our strategy going to be when you are gone? And the British and Americans, in the case of like Rhodesia and so forth, they were just sitting and counting the number of days until we collapsed. They regarded it as a total given that we were going to collapse. But I will tell you that I also walk away with the view that the length of time that we survived, the intensity of the fight we put up, and our ability to survive absolutely astounded the Anglo-American world. They never expected us to survive as long as we did. And they never expected us to put up the fight that we did. But South Africa was trying very hard to do things diplomatically and correctly. So, but you know, the CIA, the CIA watches everybody. And I've actually been reading a book about the NSA's history, and it's quite fascinating. The NSA spies on everybody in the world. Even back then, they were spying on everybody. So it's very interesting. But unfortunately, the Anglo world is so tied up in money and business that they just aren't racial. And I think that is a huge part of our problem, is that in order to do our politics, our racial politics, we almost have to cut away from Jewish globalist type of thinking. It seems to me that money thinking and focusing on trade and money brings you into direct conflict with nationalism and even more so with racialism. And we've got to carve out our own thing with it, really. Hitler was able to. I think if enough of us in the Western world do it, we can break out. But it's definitely a must. So that's as I can answer more specific questions later on. America, by the way, kind of used South Africa. And the place where they used South Africa the most was in Angola. In Angola, they were watching the victory of the Russians and the Cubans and the blacks. And later on, there was one group of blacks that was still left fighting the Cubans and Russians and the commies. And America then brought in South Africa to prop up these blacks, led by a guy called Savimbi. And South Africa under apartheid actually spent a lot of time propping up Savimbi and preventing Savimbi from being destroyed. And South Africa fought the greatest battles that have been fought in Southern Africa, including tank battles and artillery battles, full on First World style warfare. They fought in Angola at the behest of the CIA and Ronald Reagan. And personally, I've wondered to myself whether that was a good thing, whether it was good for South Africa to have bothered with doing that. Because after those tremendous battles that they fought and the years and years of fighting deep inside Angola, I don't think anything came of it that was beneficial to South Africa. I think at the end of the day, South Africa was left in the lurch and the white guys died for next to nothing. And I don't think that it was strategically that important to us. We should have fought closer to home. But they did it at the behest of the CIA, and the CIA put up the money for it. But white guys fought and died for the Western cause there, and they whipped the communists' asses in tank battles and stuff. They did really well. But at the end of the day, America still doesn't stand by you. You see, America's too weak. America's too busy with globalism to align with its own people. So for us in Southern Africa, we kept saying to ourselves, fighting the Russians and the Chinese, and make no mistake, we killed Russians and Chinese here in Southern Africa. But never once did the United States say, hey, that's good, keep going, or Israel today, for example, can go and buy any weapons it wants from America or even get the weapons for free. We didn't have access to those things. Nothing. You know, we couldn't even go and ask you guys for anything. We couldn't even have gone to you to buy stuff from you, even if we had the cash and were willing to. And there were weapons that we wanted that we were not allowed to have.
Well, Jan, quite specifically, our present government doesn't support pro-white people. And, like, it's clearly of, you know, taking up the interest of, you know, Israel and of Jews. They're too busy trying to fight anti-Semitism on both sides of the spectrum. They have monitoring of both sides, by the way. The left and the right that speaks out against Israel automatically gets monitored and put on a list. And there's even laws within the states of America, which if you protest Israel, you are deprived of any kind of hurricane relief, any kind of relief from the U.S. government. Because so most of the white people really have no say. The everyday white person doesn't have any say into their own American government, and none of the protections either if you happen to go against Israel or disagree with our foreign policy. So we're pretty much just soldier units for Israel and globalist expansion. That's pretty much it, Jan, and that's probably why U.S. has been this way probably since before and after World War II. I just think they reared their ugly head after World War II when the Jews got more power over the globe. But overall, America in itself has never really been representative, at least after World War II, of white interest. They've never taken white interest, and they never will. until, you know, sort of white people kind of either take their government back or splinter off.
Yes.
And that's that's just the reality.
I understand. I'm also just explaining some of the frustrations we had, you know, just so that you guys also understand some of the problems, you know. People try their best, you know. And then the thing about Jews infiltrating, Jews seem to have I still think that Jews need us like cattle need grass. And Jews are hunting all the time for anything, and they never seem to have a problem infiltrating even the thing that hates them the most. They seem to be absolute crazy for spying, and they always have been. And the only thing I can say is that ultimately, I think one actually has to, you have to drive them out of your organizations. That's the only thing you can do with spies. And I do think that as time goes by, the only way that we can protect ourselves is by becoming ever stricter on our own rules and on people we admit and on hunting down and getting rid of spies. We will probably find ourselves that this war that we're in will probably be the way we'll have to live for all time, probably, because you cannot leave these people alone. They will come back, and they have a long history of going back even to the places where they were chased out the longest. Look at the Spaniards. They chased the Jews out for 500 years, and now the Jews are going back there. Jews have been chased out of England and France for like 300 years, and the Jews come back. Jews are always coming back into our societies. And it looks to me like a pattern among Jews and even blacks is that they will return to the whites. They will return. Their things don't work except when they're among whites, and that's why they come. They are also a largely dysfunctional people. If they were truly functional, then they would all jump on planes, move to Israel, build Israel, and live in Israel, but they don't. You know, it's like a video that I did. There was a video where I mentioned that I did that video entitled "Jews Are the Living Proof." Jews are the living proof that capitalism is a failure. If capitalism was so good, then why don't all the Jews go to Israel and practice capitalism there? Because look at Hitler. He had national socialism, and it functioned inside the country, and its economic system worked completely correctly. But you'll find that with Jews, it's not possible, because capitalism is a kind of a parasitic system. You have to go and find other places and other peoples and other economies and get into the economies, and that's where you can make money. And Jews know that if they live by themselves, their system isn't going to work.
Yeah.
Well, how are they going to make money out of just themselves? So they've got to go into places where there are bigger populations, more developed countries, more organized things, and then they can make money there. Their greatest successes happen in white-run countries, nationalist countries. So I think that we're going to have to fight against them for all time, really. We have to take total control of our societies, much more so than in the past.
Also, I'm going to wind this down, Jan, because it's been about 2 hours now. But I do have a few questions before I leave. Maybe touch upon a little bit about what do you think about the sphere of influence of China, and what do you think about? Let's address China. What do you think about the sphere of influence of China, and like, are they a threat to the South Africaners and the Boers?
Definitely a threat to us in Southern Africa. The Chinese are a threat. And the blacks of Southern Africa, all these communist blacks, they often have their look eastward policy, and then they dash off to China and they go and talk to China. So they are very friendly with China, and they probably still are very friendly with Russia as well. In fact, the Russians sent some aircraft here a while ago. Some military aircraft a year or some time ago. Might have been last year. So the Russians and the Chinese are still good buddies with them, and they are dangerous. They are dangerous. The Russians, we have wondered whether the Russians would be people we could approach, even though in the past they were our enemies. We have wondered, and it has been a topic of discussion among us. But the Chinese definitely I see as an enemy for us. The good news is that I think China has got lots of weaknesses and lots of problems, and China also has lots of local enemies. And it's in a densely populated part of the world. So it's got lots of densely populated, powerful countries close to it, including Japan, including the Koreans, the Indians, etc. So I think as much as China's going to be a power, it's not a match for America. And I reckon that a more united Europe and an ever-strengthening Europe will also be able to deal with China. I don't see China ruling the world. I think China can be contained. But I do see them as an enemy for us. They've always assisted the blacks, and they are a danger. And if the blacks are in trouble, they will help the blacks. But the good news is that the blacks are also running out of money and stuff, and I think the blacks don't have as many friends as they used to. So things collapsing is good. That's why I'm in favor of just more collapse and then seeing what can we seize. What can we seize? You know, if we become more awakened and the whites here get more determined, my thinking is that we need to look for like a strategic opportunity and try and seize something at the right time at some point in the future. I believe that things are possible. I definitely believe things are possible. I don't see our enemies as being invincible. And the world is becoming very strange now, and I'm liking it. And COVID has just added to all the weirdness and the economic chaos. I like it. I think we could be entering a very interesting decade.
Yes.
And I think also a lot of globalism is falling apart.
Yes.
A lot of globalism is falling apart, and that's great. That's great. I think we must just hang in there and just push forward, because I think the next 10 years could be very interesting. And I wouldn't even want to predict what the world will be like in 20 years' time. I think in 20 years' time, it could be a very different place. I think there are possibilities here.
Jan, can you briefly just give people a summary of kind of drop some white pills on the people about the whole Angolan situation with the Portuguese? Because I thought that was a very powerful video you did, and that, you know, the Portuguese were outnumbered by the blacks disproportionately, but they still pulled through. And you said even like females with guns were able to push back the Angolans, which should be a white pill to a lot of white people out there. That realize when the going gets tough and the way it's going to in America, white people are resilient. And the really thing we have to worry about is sort of about other whites and white elites that may kind of turn against us. It's you know, like Metzger used to say, it's kind of a white on white kind of race war, including, you know, excluding the Jews, of course. But that's kind of the problem I've seen. It's the white elite versus sort of the more white commoner in most cases. But anyway, Jan.
Yes, I do agree with you on the Jew and the elite thing. I think that there's been a tendency by Jews to co-opt or create an elite in white countries, and then they work with that elite. And they empower that elite, and they've got a symbiotic relationship going. And I think that that is where the crux of the problem comes. So I'm totally in agreement with you. It is an elite, it is an elite versus normal person problem. And also when I was studying Quigley, and civilization, it added to my thoughts about the fact that we need to look at ourselves as the common whites and the elite whites. We have to look at ourselves in that sense. We've got to divide our countries into that group, because into that sort of grouping, because those elites are the ones who are driving the agenda, and they are gaining big benefits from the Jews, and they are the ones who are crushing the normal whites. And that's very important. But the Angola thing was very interesting for me, because I was looking for, I had read quite a long time ago about the fact that there'd been some intense violence between the blacks and the whites in Angola in 1961. But I'd never really studied the situation closely. So what I did was I looked for the best information that I could find, and it was quite a mission, but I eventually managed to get sources, and I managed to actually get actual detail of what happened in Angola when blacks set out to exterminate. Blacks in the north of Angola set out to exterminate the whites, and they did it. They made their attempt in 1961, and they prepared a massive surprise attack. The whites never saw it coming. The Portuguese didn't even think it was possible, and the next thing they know is just like that, without any warning, people are just being killed all over the show, and the blacks... The goal of the blacks was they wanted to try and exterminate the Portuguese, but they also wanted to do it in such a brutal, brutal manner that they would scare them into fleeing from the country, because this is what had happened in the Congo where the Belgians were. And the Belgians were much less in number, and the blacks were much more. The blacks outnumbered the Belgians over 100-1. So the blacks tried to do the same thing in Angola. And they thought they could pull it off. And here were these common whites in northern Angola suddenly finding themselves within a couple of hours living a total nightmare, finding out that people are being slaughtered everywhere and these blacks are attacking them. And in various places, the whites made a stand. In certain places where there were just farms, the blacks would come in large numbers and just overrun the farm, kill everybody. And they'd even kill any blacks who were friendly to the whites. But there were a couple of places where the whites survived. And the biggest battle that took place was a battle, the Battle of Carmona, where 30,000 blacks attacked 5,000 whites. And, of course, remember, there were women and children there. So you basically had an army of 30,000 blacks, some of them with guns and rifles, others with just their machetes and stuff. But 30,000 of them taking on, let's say, 2,500 white males and boys. And they fought an intense battle there. And the whites actually killed thousands of them in a total surprise attack where there was no army to assist them except for a handful of guys and one machine gun. And they fought. This is the biggest racial battle that I've ever been able to find in southern Africa, possibly even in Africa, where the blacks just came at the whites, and it's in modern times. And I was very interested in this because I wanted to look at this also as a model for what would happen in South Africa if we got into a real fight here. And after the initial battles of Carmona and those places and the whites who survived there, the whites became so infuriated and enraged, and the Portuguese army was far away and they didn't have much of an army in Angola at the time.
The Portuguese were so enraged, they went on and they slaughtered the blacks. And they ended up killing something like 50,000 blacks in that year. And the most of the deaths were probably from the Portuguese civilians. And they even drove out anything from 200,000 to 400,000 blacks out of northern Angola. The blacks, at the end of the day, were fleeing for their lives, were even running out of the country. And it was these Portuguese who just did their thing. And they were so enraged because their friends and family had been killed. They were absolutely livid. And they killed and killed and killed like crazy. And it was, and I regard that Angola as really the example for the future, that this is what South Africa could come to one day. And this could happen maybe in other places. But it does show clearly that when whites are left to their own devices of defending themselves as they think in their normal way, that they are more than capable of doing so, more than capable of doing so. And of course, those whites didn't have anything of the weapons like you guys have got these days. The kinds of weapons you guys have got, you have no threat that's gonna be a problem for you. The biggest problems we have are the traitors. It really is. The traitors in the elite and the traitors among us. And we need to, those are the people that are our real problem. They are the ones making the non-whites win. If it had to be just white on black, or even whites against other non-whites, it's a no-brainer. You know, unless you were fighting the Japanese or somebody, if you're fighting the blacks, they're nothing to be worried about. And it also has good bodings for South Africa. And unfortunately, many people here are still too afraid, but I believe we'll be fine. If we had to be thrown into all-out, total, wild conflict, I think we'll be fine. You know, you're going to have people getting killed. There are going to be nasty things. One doesn't know, will I live the first day? Will I live to the 10th day? But as a group, we'll definitely survive. No question about it. No question about it.
Well, I'm going to wind this down, Jan. Do you want to share about a little bit of the predicament you're in South Africa right now with the legal situation?
Okay, I'll quickly give you some feedback. Basically, in South Africa, we've got an organization. I'm not going to mention its name, but it is basically the equivalent of the ADL in your country. And they go around South Africa also hunting for anybody, and they take them to court, and they have gone after many people, even blacks. And I got a visit from the police on the 24th of July with a criminal charge of crimen injuria from a Jew who is high ranking in this ADL type organization. And that was my first big surprise. I had never had anything like it before. And so this was quite a concern for me. And I went and got a bit of legal advice, etc. So far, that has not gone to trial, and it might not go to trial. But then, about a week ago, last week, which is now 5 days ago, I got another visit from the police, and this time it was the same ADL person. And this time I was charged with harassment. So I have to go to court for this early in November. And who knows what other things may come up. So it looks like they got their sights on me. And to my knowledge, I'm the only person in South Africa who's ever been charged by them with crimen injuria. And I'm the only person who's been charged with harassment. Normally, they just take you to the Equality Court for hate speech, but it looks like they have singled me out and they're trying to find every possible means to take me down. And I think I'm going to be finding myself in quite a lot of legal struggles. And it is very clear from the documentation that they want me shut down completely. They specifically state that they want my websites taken down, and they say they want all my social media accounts shut down, and they also say that they even want my phones and computers seized. They want everything. They want to shut me down completely. So for me, the whole struggle will be to see which things I can manage to keep. Can I even manage to keep any of my free speech? What am I going to be able to do? So I think I'm heading into quite a wild 2021. But my first court appearance will be early in November.
And I want to encourage everybody to support Jan. And we want to thank you, Jan, on behalf of the stream for being a champion for our people and for fighting and for not giving up, no matter how much pressure is applied to you. And we know you've taken many great hardships to do this and for spreading the message out there. And I think in the end, we will be victorious.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your support and understanding. I am doing my utmost, and rest assured, I will do my utmost to keep on getting the message out to the utmost of my ability, no matter what they do. I will try and see what I can do, because for me, my view is that the messages are so important that if they shut us down, if they shut all of us down, then we're going to die. Then we're really finished. But we've all got to keep going, and we've got to keep that discussion and information flowing between our people, or else we're going to die. That to me is a greater threat than any physical or military threat. That's how I see it.
Also, Jan, is there any way we can support you? You know, any way the audience can support you, or people listening to this can support you in any way?
I would be grateful if people can drop me a line on my History Reviewed website. I've got a donations page. Because of the harassment and the intensity of the harassment, I don't publish my details openly. So people have to leave a message for me, and then I will talk to them. That is the only way that I can do things, because they've shut down and gone after every conceivable mode of moving money. But that is the best. And I will email you a link as well.
Okay.
I'll be grateful if you can spread that.
I will.
I'll be most grateful.
And I want to encourage you guys, support Jan, because he is not a grifter. He is not trying to do this to exploit this cause. He's pretty true to this cause. And he's done this on a shoestring budget. He's done this without little support of very few people. And I think he's one of the voices that needs to be supported. And I hope you guys support him in his battle. Anything else you want to say maybe about your case or anything else about South Africa, Jan, before you leave this?
I don't have anything offhand. I'm looking forward to the U.S. election. I hope Trump gets in. I think it's a bit better than anything else. Trump at least stirs things, and that is good. And I really hope you guys, you know, just make the most of every minute that you've got. We must all just work as hard as we can. I definitely believe that survival is possible, definitely. So don't give up.
We want to not just survive. We want to not just
survive,
Jan. We want to thrive. We don't just want to survive.
Absolutely.
We want to thrive, and we want to bring the right white race back, and We even want Imperium if we have to.
I like it. I like it. It sounds like the Roman Empire. It sounds like National Socialism. I'm all for that. I'm all for that. Bring back, to me, the Wehrmacht was the new Roman army.
Yes.
And that's what we need. And we are capable of that. And I think I can end by saying, keep watching the videos that I'm going to put out from Southern Africa. You're going to see how the whites of Southern Africa, as outnumbered as we were, we landed big punches. Don't believe that you're going to be wiped out. You're going to see you are more than capable of surviving. Just like you say, thriving is possible. And many great things are possible. For now, we are all thinking of secession and seizing a little chunk here, a little chunk there. But you never know. 20 years from now, we could be on the attack. We might even be gaining territory. So don't write any of us off, including us in South Africa. Don't write us off yet.
Absolutely.
It may take a while.
And that said,
thank
guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jan. And you're welcome back anytime you want, Jan. And with that said, guys, hell the boar. And see you, Kyle.
These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.